And so, anyway, this is the 100th lecture. We're honored to have Bruce give such. And so I will leave it at that. And welcome, Bruce Freeman, to give the 100th lecture.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks. I guess what I'm going to talk to you about today is a culmination of two bad career decisions that someone can make. One is to work with evanescent, promiscuously reactive species that are difficult to detect, and then applying that field to a field where you're working with water and soluble molecules. So it's really a difficult area for detection and quantitative analysis. Let me get you started with just a couple of, I put a bunch of things in the PowerPoint handout that you have, but there's some really cool aspects of development in lipid oxidation over the years that really impressed me at how people's creativity and also the technology that they had available to them could be brought to bear to make some discoveries. One is that in 1800, walnut oil was shown to consume a lot of oxygen, 150-fold its volume. And we now know that that's due to lipid oxidation. Diesel built an engine that ran on peanut oil in 1895. Red cell membranes that it was calculated were two molecules thick way back. The word antioxidants was coined in the early 20s, and it was identifying a phenolic substance that prevented oxidation of fats. Hydroperoxides were then identified as constituents of rancid fats. The field really jumped forward in the early 50s when technology for separation of lipids became available, and rotor evaporators, if anyone's used that device, and has seen them bump, and you lose everything that you're working on up into the condensation coil. In 1980, Ned Porter at Duke University, I'm sure, was capitalizing on the seminal observations of Friedovich and McCord, and made the first report of free radical oxidation of membrane phospholipids. Sam Parthasarathy and Steinberg and others at UC San Diego pioneered the concept that lipoproteins would be oxidized and they had a proatherogenic role. The discoveries related to eicosanoid signaling resulted in an 82 Nobel Prize. Discoveries related to cholesterol metabolism and cardiovascular disease, an 85 Nobel Prize. The seminal observations of Morrow and Roberts discovering isoprostanes was in 90. And also a class of nuclear lipid receptors that include steroid and fatty acid receptors was described in 90 and is likely a candidate for a Nobel Prize. So lipids were first viewed as kind of structural in nature and not signaling molecules. And also they were metabolic precursors for beta oxidation in mitochondria. And then the whole field has evolved, and it's continuing to evolve now, and I think that there's still many exciting new discoveries that our young people that are here at the Free Radical School can make, and even some of us old guys. So a new view is that there can be an exquisitely controlled enzymatic and also an autocatalytic oxidation of lipids that yields cell signaling mediators, and we have evolved receptors for these compounds, and we've also evolved transcription factors and enzymes that can be exquisitely sensitive to oxidized lipids. On the left is a G-protein-coupled receptor. There's about 1,000 of them that have been described. More than half don't really have an identified ligand, and we know that prostaglandins recognize GPCRs as their or GPCRs recognize prostaglandins. On the right is the proxisome proliferator activated receptor that's forming a heterodimer with the RXR receptor, and I'll mention a little bit more about that as we progress. But let's start with the foundations. Fatty acids, just for general discussion purposes, why don't we assume that the principal fatty acids that we would deal with in a biological situation range from about 14 carbons to 22 carbons. They are saturated when they have no double bonds, unsaturated when they contain double bonds, polyunsaturated when they contain multiple double bonds. Counting back from the methyl carbon, you'll have your omega value for the fatty acid. So if it's three carbons in, that's an omega-3 fatty acid. Six carbons in is an omega-6 fatty acid. So different unsaturated fatty acids will have a different omega value. This is one of the problems of trying to study lipids. In any single cell, you're going to have about 180,000 different lipids. When you take all of the backbones and all of the different classes of lipids that you can have, and then you esterify or react with that backbone unsaturated fatty acids of different carbon length and degrees of unsaturation. So molecular masses, if you're just following molecular masses as well as unique species, there's about 180,000 different ones per cell on average. So the field of lipidomics is still something that is in its infancy as we try to describe the panel of lipids in a cell and how they might shift after, say, inflammatory activation. Phospholipids are a key element of the lipid family in many cells, and some of the most abundant are phosphatidylcholine, ethanolamine. They're sharing a glycerol backbone, three carbons long, and they are esterified typically at the carbon 1 position with a saturated fatty acid, and at the carbon 2 position, typically an unsaturated fatty acid, and then a phosphoryl R group, and that varies depending on the phospholipid. They have different charge characteristics, different partitioning on a membrane. Some may be in pools on the outer layer of a bilayer. Others may be on the interface of a membrane. And in the case of phosphatidyl inositol, when I was in graduate school, people realized that when you activated a cell, the phosphatidyl inositol would disappear quickly. And now we know that there's this elegant signaling pathway that involves the inositol phosphate derivatives as well as diglyceride products from that hydrolysis reaction. At the number one carbon in glycerolipids, you can have different linkages, an ester linkage, a 1,0-alkyl linkage, and also what's called a vinyl ether substituent or 1,0-alk-1-enyl. And we heard yesterday from Mike Davies, for example, that this vinyl ether lipid is exquisitely reactive with myeloperoxidase-derived species. And the products of the reactions between HOCl and other MPO-derived species, when they attack this double bond, those products can propagate some of the inflammatory injury mediated by myeloperoxidase. I remember 10, 20 years ago, these vinyl ether lipids were proposed to be antioxidant in endothelial cells because they were in the outer leaflet, susceptible to reaction with singlet oxygen. I never really thought that was a very good idea, and it hasn't survived. One very important characteristic of lipids, remember I told you that the C2 carbon in the glycerol tends to have an unsaturated fatty acid bound to it. Well, it turns out that when this carbon 2, number 2 fatty acid gets oxidized, it acquires a more polar property, and it can flip a little bit out of the plane of the membrane. Bottom line is it's more susceptible to phospholipase A2 hydrolysis. And this discovery was made by one of our own, Alex Savanian, who I first met when I was a graduate student, and unfortunately he's no longer with us. But this is one of Alex's very seminal observations, that this phospholipase A2 interaction with hydrophilic fatty acids initiates downstream signaling events that can occur with an oxidized or modified fatty acid after lipid oxidation. This is, everybody has to have science as a mess slide. You saw Neil Hogg's superoxide, hydroxyl radical, peroxynitrite. This is just to let you know that you can come to another free radical school and hear someone talk about lipoxygenase reactions, PGHS synthase reactions for producing prostaglandins, and online are two or three free radical school lectures about isoprostanes that have been presented, or award lectures from Jason Morrow and Jack Roberts. So this is an area of signaling mediators that I'm not going to get into in this sort of random lipid oxidation presentation today. So what is lipid oxidation? If we just take linoleic acid, which is 18 carbons long with two double bonds, and when linoleic acid is attacked by a free radical, you'll abstract a hydrogen and have an intermediate that undergoes isomerization to a conjugated diene, where the radical will then either be on the 9 or the 13 position. This reacts very quickly with molecular oxygen to form a lipid peroxyl radical. And at this point, alpha tocopherol can terminate that radical and give you a hydroperoxide. Or this peroxyl radical can go on and abstract another hydrogen from another unsaturated fatty acid. And this is called a propagation reaction. And antioxidants serve to terminate chain propagation reactions. The speed of propagation is relatively slow. It's about 10 to the third mole per second. That rate constant is a function of the chain length and the degree of the unsaturation of a fatty acid, too. If it's got two double bonds and 18 carbons, this will be the rate constant for propagation. If there's 22 carbons with six double bonds, you tend to propagate at a faster rate. Alpha tocopherol reacts reasonably quickly with lipid peroxyl radicals to give us the hydroperoxide. And things can get started all over again if transition metals are present and the hydroperoxide breaks down to an alkoxyl radical or an epoxy allylic radical, where actually you have a carbon center double bond and this has formed an epoxide. And that's a very potent propagating species as well. And NO is lipid soluble, reacts very, very quickly with lipid peroxyl radicals, and inhibits propagation reactions as well. So the principal products of lipid oxidation are ethane and pentane, and measuring ethane and pentane as byproducts of lipid peroxidation in vivo is a strategy that many people have used. It can be affected by your diet. If a bus drives by down the street and releases some combustion products, that'll affect your results. 4-hydroxynonenal is an electrophilic product. Malonaldehyde is a dialdehyde. Conjugated fatty acids are present naturally, dietarily, and they can also be formed as products of lipid oxidation. Hydroperoxides are a typical, relatively stable byproduct, and also the isoprostane class, which is probably the most robust species that you can measure to indicate both systemic lipid oxidation or oxidative stress. And isoprostanes, as time goes on, will be revealed to be very important signaling molecules. Iron enhances lipid oxidation. I always think of Friedovich and McCord and some of the work that they did in this area, and also Steve Ost, who's here at this meeting. In fact, I ripped off this slide from Steve Ost in a previous presentation of his that I found online. But Steve basically presented us with the insight that if you rigorously remove metals from your buffer systems, and then you begin to try to initiate lipid oxidation with something like hydrogen peroxide, you don't really have a significant degree or rate of lipid oxidation. And what really catalyzes it is the reduction of iron and then the interaction of iron with superoxide, hydrogen peroxide. An interesting aspect that nitric oxide brings to lipid oxidation is that you can have metal ion independent lipid peroxidation. So if you chelex your buffers and have chelators present, peroxynitrite from work that Rafael Roddy did, still is able to initiate lipid oxidation. So iron is clearly something that pushes this reaction forward. I won't get into this in detail because Al Jarrahi, online, you can find a presentation from him. And we can't ignore the reactions with cholesterol. Cholesterol has double bond in the backbone, and it's very susceptible to oxidation by ozone, peroxynitrite, metal hydrogen peroxide catalyzed species, singlet oxygen, and gives a variety of products which also have bioactivity. In addition, you'll have fatty acids attached to sterols, and the most susceptible lipid for oxidation in our bodies is cholesterol linoleate, and that insight came to us from Hermann Esterbauer. It's the most abundant oxidizable lipid in your plasma. So cholesterol linoleate is just going to have the 18-carbon, 2-double-bond fatty acid esterified there. Nitric oxide, we cannot ignore. Ever since the late 80s, early 90s, I became convinced that it plays an integral role in the damaging and signaling actions of reactive oxygen species. It basically accelerates the rate and also increases the breadth of reactions that can transduce redox signaling, and it promotes a lot of covalent target molecule reactions that you wouldn't otherwise have with the traditional class of ROS. NO concentrates in membranes about 10 to 20 fold. So does oxygen. So you have an environment where you can have NO auto-oxidation occur at an accelerated rate. Both cyclooxygenases and lipoxygenases, from work of Daniela Salvameni, as well as a variety of other investigators, NO regulates the gene expression of enzymes that enzymatically modify lipids. It participates in reactions that can stimulate lipid oxidation and also reactions that inhibit lipid oxidation. And during ongoing lipid oxidation, since NO reacts with lipid radicals, you will have a consumption of NO as well. So an actively turning over lipoxygenase or cyclooxygenase will lower steady-state concentrations of NO and affect product profiles from the COX and the LOX and steady-state concentrations of NO. Okay, so here's an example of how if you use xanthine plus xanthine oxidase and go back 10 or 20 years and use a thiobarbituric acid reaction to measure lipid oxidation, it was reasonably well accepted at the time in 1990, 1991, 92. And XX plus XO in the presence of some iron EDTA caused a significant increase in oxidation of artificial membranes made with egg phosphatidylcholine. And then if you introduced in just a little bit of NO, you form peroxynitrite, and we got much more lipid oxidation occurring in this experiment. At higher concentrations or rates of introduction of NO, you see that inhibitory effect of NO towards lipid oxidation. If you look at these reactions in a variety of ways, you can learn that NO outperforms vitamin E about 2,000-fold in terms of inhibiting lipid peroxidation chain propagation reactions. And you also get a real gamish of oxidized and nitrated species that are still confounding us. Ooh, this went crazy. which is just like the experiment. This is actually a fantastic experiment, and we can get through. I don't know how these lines popped up here. This is the first time I've ever seen it. Valerie O'Donnell took an unsaturated fatty acid in this experiment and exposed it to an azo initiator of lipid peroxidation. And this azo compound undergoes a decay reaction, reacts with molecular oxygen, forms a peroxyl radical. And when the azo initiator was added here, we used the most simple measure of oxidant reaction, which is O2 consumption. Oh, there we go. It cleaned up. What did you guys do? You don't know either? Okay. And you can see that there is a... This sucks. The azo initiator stimulated O2 consumption, and this is both the azo initiator reacting with O2, but it's also stimulating propagation reactions of lipid peroxyl radicals. And when alpha tocopherol was added, which was reducing the LOO dot to LOOH, then we inhibited the propagation reactions. And when tocopherol was fully consumed, you would go back to your initial rate of lipid peroxidation chain propagation reactions where O2 was adding onto the unsaturated fatty acid. And then adding a little bit of NO, for as long as the NO was around, you fully inhibited O2 consumption. And then when NO was consumed, it started up again, and adding another bolus of NO inhibited lipid oxidation. So I show you this just to exemplify how tocopherol and something like NO can inhibit these chain propagation reactions. Going a little bit further, and this harks back to what I said about lipoxygenase and cyclooxygenase, O'Donnell also saw that the enzyme-bound lipid peroxyl radical in lipoxygenase will react with NO and form a lipid peroxyl radical NO intermediate. There's ultimately two molecules of NO consumed for every cycle of lipoxygenase. So there's this intimate relation between these enzymatically generated mediators of inflammation and NO. NO is consumed. NO affects rates of product production. And also, backing off a little bit, NO affects the gene expression of lipoxygenase in the first place. So let me communicate to you what I have as a new perspective about lipid oxidation. When many of us started out in our careers in this field, we thought of oxidation processes and free radical reactions as molecular hammers that cause damage and toxicity. I think that lipid oxidation is actually a very subtle way of the cell taking advantage of byproducts of ongoing reactions that can occur at different rates during inflammation to produce a set of products that in turn will activate adaptive signaling mechanisms that are mediated by receptors, transcription factors, and protein kinases. I really haven't woken up. I was pointing the pointer at my personal little screen here. I'm just in my own world up here. No wonder my friends don't respect me. So here's I'll give you three or four examples. NF-kappa-B. There's a complex between I-kappa-B and P50, P65, and there's a crucial cysteine in P65 subunit. I-kappa-B kinase will result in processing, ubiquitination, and proteasomal degradation of I-kappa-B. The P50, P65 subunit will diffuse to the nucleus and acts as a transcription factor, inhibits cytokine gene expression, NOS2, a variety of other chemokines. And if you electrophilically adduct that sulfhydryl with some electrophilic fatty acid derivative, you prevent DNA binding and you prevent expression of these downstream pro-inflammatory mediators. Another example, there's a really cool experiment going on in across the Pacific right now in Asia. An investigator who plays a seminal role in the KEAP1 NRF2 signaling pathway, Tom Kensler, has developed a broccoli tea. I'm sure it tastes like just awful. But the broccoli, when you dip it into hot water, it extracts electrophiles. And Tom has seen in cell and animal model systems that these electrophilic lipids from the broccoli tea will induce NRF2-dependent gene expression. So this broccoli tea is providing a lipid electrophile which reacts with critical sulfhydryls on KEAP1, which stimulates the ubiquitination and degradation of Keep 1 and allows Nrf2 to diffuse to the nucleus and activate its transcriptional program, which includes elevating hemoxygenase 1, glutathione biosynthetic enzymes, just a whole slew of anti-inflammatory adaptive enzymes. So here's an example where an electrophile can be used to upregulate Nrf2-dependent gene expression. And in this population of people that Tom is studying, he's looking at their ability to accelerate clearance of aflatoxin, which is a carcinogenic compound present that can be handled by Nrf2-dependent genes. Here's an image from Anupam Agarwal on how profound an electrophilic fatty acid can perform in terms of just inducing one enzyme, hemoxygenase 1. So it was a 2 or 3 nanomolar plasma concentration of an electrophile, and within 4, 6, 8 hours, big upregulation of a very anti-inflammatory gene. Another hot area, I think, that's prime for investigation, and we just had a wonderful poster here at the meeting on that yesterday that I got a chance to see, is the heat shock factor-dependent family of genes, which are heat shock proteins. There's a number of heat shock factors when they're exposed to electrophiles or oxidants. They have critical sulfhydryls that people are being that are identified now and more to be identified. Upon oxidation of these proteins, they form a trimer and form the transcriptional regulatory complex that diffuses to the nucleus and regulates heat shock protein expression. And this is turning out to be a very important responsive mechanism to electrophiles. The last I'll mention is the PPAR receptors. The PPAR gamma ligands that are sold in the pharmaceutical industry to treat metabolic and inflammatory disease is a $16 billion a year market. And just 2 weeks ago, the American Diabetes Association recommended that the synthetic ligands be taken off the market. PPAR recognizes fatty acids and oxidized lipids. When the receptor interacts with a lipid, you'll have an alteration in co-repressor binding and a recruitment in co-activator proteins, very complex process that's exquisitely under the control of specific ligands for the receptor. You'll form a heterodimer with the RXR, retinoic acid complex, and regulate anti-inflammatory and metabolic-related genes. The ligands for PPAR are going to define what sort of pattern of co-regulator proteins interact. And over the years, unsaturated fatty acids, hydroxy fatty acids, hydroperoxy fatty acids, 15-deoxy-PGJ2, leukotrienes, rosiglitazone is a $16 billion a year drug that's causing some adverse myocardial effects, nitro derivatives of fatty acids, and alpha-beta unsaturated ketones are ligands for this PPAR receptor. And again, it's electrophilic chemistry in action. Just published in Nature Structural Molecular Biology is work from a group that saw that alpha-beta unsaturated ketones actually covalently adduct the receptor by having a reaction at the cysteine 285 and the electrophilic carbon in the fatty acid. Very unique receptor interaction. Very cool. And you can imagine some of the opportunities for drug development just taking advantage of that unique receptor interaction. So that's the end of my talk. One promise that I have to the people who would like to get into this sometimes nightmarish but always exciting area is we'll upload methods for measuring reactive species onto the website, and so you can see some of the lab protocols that we have. I would start out with oxygen consumption. Always take advantage of HPLC mass spec strategies if you have those available. It's expensive, but that's really the way that you can drill down and look at specific mediators. Thank you.
So we have time for a couple of questions. Robin?
Hey, Bruce, that's wonderful. Excellent. Just an editorial comment. You know, before uploading this on the website, just send a methods paper to Henry Foreman.
And, FRBM?
Yeah.
Well, we did write the review you guys have been all over us on. Right, Henry?
Bashar from the University of São Paulo. I would like to add, you know, to your talk, congratulations, you know, very nice talk, the fact that the lipoperoxidation is a chemiluminescent process. No, so that, yeah, you talked about, you know, the biochemistry of lipoperoxidation in the ground state. But we know that the Russell reaction, you know, from the peroxyl radical intermediates, which is one of the termination steps, produces 10% of singlet oxygen and 0.1% of tripped carbonyls. And tripped carbonyls, they behave like alkoxyl radicals. They can abstract hydrogen, undergo cycloadditions, isomerizations, fragmentation, etc. And unfortunately, the community is not aware, you know, of this aspect of the tripped ketones, you know, which could drive a photochemical process without light, you know, as Chile in São Paulo used to say.
I think we have a candidate for a Sunrise Free Radical School lecture. Chemiluminescence and reactive species. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't cover that. But I asked for an hour and he wouldn't give it to me.
He almost took it, so. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll take a break now and then start with the plenary section. This was a great morning, and so great appreciation to both our speakers. Thanks.